Welcome to The Bookshelf, and welcome back to The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. Tonight, we resume Jonathan's story in the middle of January 29th, his mother's birthday, 5 years after her death.
Crail is a cold and lonely place today. The sea beyond the seawall is marbled gray and white on the faces of big waves. The constant, hollow sound of wind comes down the chimney and pushes in through the thinnest gaps in the window frames on the other side of this desk. Yet, there's a strange company in the dreariness. It is so much my own state of mind. All day the wind blows and the swells build, a symphony churning up a long, constant crescendo to high tide and the last light of day when waves bang into the seawall, shoot 30 or 40 feet in the air, blow to mist in the wind that coats my little squares of window panes with a salty film, and fall back down to drench the seawall and run in white rivulets over the old stones and down the worn stone steps and stacks of lobster creels and into the harbor. The little fishing boats pivot and pull and bob against their lines. Light blue and dark blue and yellow and white, they twist restlessly and rock with their orange life preservers stacked two and three between their antennae atop their tiny cockpits. Out where the horizon would be, if the horizon could be seen through the firmament into which the sea disappears, a white light flashes the position of the May Isle Lighthouse. Another wave explodes over the seawall, demolishes itself up into a million sudden fragments, and falls to wash over the fitted rocks and stream over the mortar and the grooves between. And another wave, and another. And like any good symphony, the storm takes me far from where it had me begin. My dreariness goes, blown and battered into an insistence, a resolution, a kind of strength that is part strife, part exuberance, part cleansing grief. Amy will have a nice fire in the fireplace downstairs. I can smell the garlic and brine of her red clam sauce on the stove. Some of our friends from the village must be here, as expected, for dinner and cards. Through my shut door, I hear Anya and her school chum Emma playing happily in Anya's room across the hall. Before I go down, I'll click off my desk lamp and sit in the blue near dark and give myself a few more waves shooting up long rows of spray along the seawall. Amy's good about the birthdays of people in her life. She never lets one go by without some kind of commemoration. January 29th, as we were tucking Anya in at the end of the day, Amy suggested we each tell some memories of my mom. "Okay," Anya said, and crunched a dry Cheerio, her usual bedtime snack, a snack she and her Nana had shared in bed often. "I'd like that very much," I said, and lay down on one side of Anya while Amy lay down on the other. "I remember she pushed me the first time I swung in Melissa," Anya started right in. I could picture her, 2 years old, in the blue plastic whale swing in my parents' backyard. My mother was in a wheelchair by then, but she was also out there in the sunshine, wheels in the grass, pushing on Melissa's whale nose every time Anya swung forward, making a wide-eyed face of surprise and joy, as if every arrival were a new discovery of her granddaughter. 2 years old would be early to have formed such a memory. We have pictures of that afternoon, though. And whenever we visit that house, the same Melissa is out there waiting, a foot of snow on her head sometimes, but always waiting. I told about watching my mom and Amy give Anya a bath in the kitchen sink, how they bent together over the little baby that forever would bond them, poured warm water over a measuring cup slowly over the wisps of hair on that tiny head. I told Anya that Nana had to stand the whole time on her one good foot, but she didn't mind. And then they took you out and wrapped you in a towel on the counter. You lay there and Nana leaned down and brought her face very close to your face and your eyes. She spoke very softly, and your eyes stared back up at her. I told it straight, just like that, without commentary. But what I remember now about that kitchen sink bath of Anya's is the feeling I had, seeing these three generations of women, the love between them in hands touching clean baby skin, and realizing I'd done this, and Amy'd done it too. No matter what else I did or didn't accomplish in my life, I'd fallen in love with her and stuck beside her, and we brought this baby home to my mother, who was now a nana and the most contented I'd ever seen her. Amy's memory was next. It was from the same kitchen at my parents' house, 2 years later at the breakfast table, Nana in her wheelchair and Anya in her lap, the two of them stirring a big enamel bowl of chocolate chip cookie dough. Together, you'd say, mix, 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 as you stirred, Amy recalled. I came in and there was flour and sugar all over the table, and I said I was sorry about that, and Nana said, that's okay. She never minded a mess to clean up. You guys must have finished the batter with an electric mixer, because I remember you sitting in her lap later and each of you licking clean a beater, big smiles on your faces. I remember, Anya said. Once again, I was grateful for the picture Amy had taken, my mom and Anya with big smiles and their cookie dough beaters. My turn again, she continued. I remember sitting in Nana's lap and us rolling in her wheelchair down the ramp into her garden and me asking to do it again and us doing it again. My next memory was of the kitchen again, but this time looking in. My mom was at the breakfast table, where so many times she watched for us to pull into the driveway beside the big kitchen window, and where she'd watch us back out and go, often for months, hundreds of miles of highway away from her. Whether we were coming or going, for months or for hours, she'd wave two hands at us, big, reaching waves of joy. I remember us pulling up, and she'd be sitting there, paging through a gardening catalog, thinking about new flowers for the backyard. She'd see our headlights and look up and smile and wave both hands. We'd park and let Yukon out of the truck, and he'd make straight for the door, hold his nose right by the doorknob and push his big, heavy body through as soon as I opened it and go straight to my mom. And then you'd toddle in, and then my mom would be petting Yukon and holding you, and she'd call out, "The kids are here!" Then my dad would come in from his evening nap on the living room sofa and declare, "You made it!" And Nana would say, "They sure did." Anya thought about this scene, half remembering, half reconstructing it, smiled and yawned. It was about time for us to wish her sweet dreams and pay her the day's last kiss. But Amy had one more memory. This one was from long before Anya was born, from before the Fair Avenue kitchen and backyard, from the days when my family had lived in Marquette only a couple years and were still in our tiny apartment on the campus of Northern Michigan University, where my dad was a new assistant professor. I was a senior at Marquette High School, a couple blocks away, and Amy was a junior. We were still just friends. We weren't a couple yet, Amy explained. We used to drive around in my parents' Subaru, sometimes with our friends, but sometimes just the two of us. We'd drive all over town talking, to Presque Isle, to the beach, to Frosty Treats. One day, I spilled a milkshake in the car, and I was just panicked. "You were worried to go home?" Anya asked. "Yeah, the milkshake was on the seats and all over between them and on the shifter. And Daddy said, 'Let's take it to my mom.'" It was the first time I met her. She gathered washcloths and towels and a bucket of soapy water and came out and cleaned it right up, no problem. "There," she said kindly to me, "good as new." It was the right place to end my mother's birthday, a story of her happy to be able to put things right for someone, the start of the big story of her and Amy's 18-year friendship, the first of countless confidences between them. "The other day, when you told me it was coming up on 5 years, for a minute I thought that couldn't be right," Amy said, as she packed our toiletries, our passports, and her camera into her day pack. Gray light of morning was coming up over the sea out the window. I slid a fresh yellow legal pad into one of the two small suitcases we'd packed last night. February 7. The date on the other end of my mother's life. 9 days after her birthday. The date of her death. The date that waited on the calendar all those years, like a pebble on a forest path. This was the 5th anniversary, and Amy, Anya, and I were going to Paris. It was yet another extravagance we couldn't really afford, but it felt right. She would have loved that, John, my dad had said on the phone from Michigan when I'd told him our plan. Amy said so too, in the car as we drove through a light flurry toward the Edinburgh airport, past snow-filled fields and hedgerows of black and dark gray trees in relief against the white. She'd have thought about all of us there. She'd have wanted us to tell her everything we planned and wanted to hear every detail when we got back. It was that thing everyone I've ever known who has lost someone does, say aloud what the one they've lost would have said or felt or done. I've heard it said there's a kind of tyranny in this, a taking of identity from the dead person who was powerless to be anything but what the living would have them be. Perhaps that's so for some. I can see how it very well could be. But what's true for me, and others I've heard say their dead would have loved or hated or enjoyed or laughed at something, is that we don't stop knowing someone when they die. Yes, the world goes on, unbelievably, idiotically, cruelly, indifferently, gracefully, beautifully, it goes on. And yes, the dead person is left behind. However, when we sense and then say how that person would have reacted to what the new days bring, it's because we still know them. And because we still know them, they still have a relationship to the world that has moved on from their time. Amy and my dad were right. My mom would have loved the thought of my little family headed off to Paris. She would have lived vicariously in our modest adventure while we were there and would have listened until we were exhausted from telling about it when it was over. Today, I'm thinking about what a good listener your Nana was, Amy said to Anya as I drove the winding road through oncoming snowflakes. Your Nana was a very, very good listener. She'd remember... Amy was quiet a long time. She didn't continue speaking until she could do so without quavering. She'd remember all the details of what people told her, and she'd ask about really specific things later. It was true. Often my mother would remember the college class schedules or job prospects or illnesses or vacation plans or daydreams of people with whom she spoke, even casually. She'd recall the names of people she'd never met because those people mattered to the people around her. And she'd ask by name about this teacher or coworker or that relative or friend or romantic interest. She'd remember what the people who spoke to her cared about and hold on to it until their next conversation. She and I would just sit and talk for hours and hours, Amy continued. I really want to be a listener like that for people. I glanced in the rearview mirror and saw Anya in her booster seat, staring out the window contemplatively. She was the kindest person we'll probably ever know, Amy said. And we know a lot of very kind people, she hastened to add. I had that particular feeling of comfort one gets when a key personal truth is confirmed by another human being. The enormity of my mother's spirit wasn't something I'd conjured in my mind these last 5 years. It was so. At least, Amy believed it was so. And I trust her more than anyone else to tell me what's real. What did I do when she died? Anya asked. Amy explained that she and Anya were at her parents' house, a half an hour away from mine, when I called and said Nana had died. You had questions. I remember you asked if that meant she was out of breath. Amy said she gave Anya a choice about coming with her to town, and Anya had wanted to, had asked if she could see Nana one more time. Was I scared? Anya asked. A little, Amy said, when you saw she wasn't breathing or moving. But you also wanted to be there. I remembered. I led Anya into the bedroom. Amy had gone in for her turn alone, and was sitting in a chair beside the bed, my mother beside her, propped up with pillows at her back. Two friends, side by side one last time. Purple blotches were forming on my mother's ears, and though I'd closed her eyes, her mouth hung slightly open. Anya leaned over onto Amy's lap and kept her gaze fixed on her Nana. Amy stroked Anya's hair. On we drove into the present day. Do you know what an obituary is? Amy asked. No, Anya said. Amy explained the term and told Anya that I'd sat down and written Nana's that same afternoon, all about her life and the people she loved. "Was I in it?" Anya asked. "Of course," I said. "You were the arrival. You were the new person, the next piece of our family. The best thing about the last years of her life was you." Amy went on to tell how we all, she and Anya, my dad and sister, my mother's sister and brother and I, had gone to Vango's Pizza on 3rd Street for lunch. To myself, I recalled that we'd left so as to be gone when the undertaker came to the house with his long black car and wheeled my mother forever away from her home in Snowdover Garden. Later, when I spoke to him in his office at the funeral home, I was struck by how young the undertaker seemed in his crisp shirt and suit, his hair cut to a buzz above his ears. He was much younger than me. My mom would have liked that, I recalled thinking. She was a champion of those just starting off, sympathetic to their need to prove themselves and find a place in the world. It was the first time I thought how she would have felt about something in the world she did not know. Amy told Anya how the sun came out the day my mother died, and the rest of us all drove out to the rocky Lake Superior shore at Presque Isle. A few hours of spring in the midst of winter. We parked at the log pavilion where we'd had Anya's first birthday, just above the paved path along which I'd pushed my mother in her wheelchair, Anya in her lap, into the summer wind off the lake and the seagulls holding the air around them. "She loved seagulls?" Anya said in her half-question, half-statement inflection. "That's right," I said. "She certainly did." Our plane rose from the Scottish snow up into the sunshine, but it was snowing again as we made our descent. Anya polished off her Air France hot chocolate and declared it one of the best hot chocolates in the world. It was the first detail of our trip I'd have told my mom, and they continued to add up. As we taxied toward the terminal, the captain welcomed us to Paris in French, and again in English. Vivaldi came softly on the PA. "No lack for flair, the French," I'd have told my mom. I'd been worried that Anya would be worn out by the day's travel and our talk of her Nana's death. To my surprise, though, she was giddy to be in Paris. Normally, she merely tolerates eating out, and, finicky eater that she is, often rejects her food after one bite and a guilty shrug and a meek, "sorry," as soon as the waiter is out of sight. But at the first taste of her first Parisian meal, a simple poached salmon, she went wide-eyed and said, "It's the best salmon in the world. Every bite is a little bit of heaven." And a short time later, she discovered that, like Air France's hot chocolate and her first French salmon, her first French chocolate mousse was quite to her liking. Our lean, jovial waiter checked in on us and smiled. "She's the princess, yes?" "Ah, yes," I confessed, "the princess." From the restaurant, we rushed to Pointe Neuf on the Seine to make an 8 p.m. boat cruise. Anya led the way and tugged on our hands as we ran. Amy and I were in Paris the summer I was 20 and she was 19. We'd taken a night cruise down the river then, sitting atop the tour boat with our cheese and bread and bottle of wine. Amy showed the photos to my mom when we got home. Now, 21 years later, we had an 8-year-old with us. An 8-year-old who could not have been more pleased to be there, among the few people braving the open seats atop this tour boat in the chilly night air. "Take a picture of me in front of it," she told Amy, when the highest twinkling lights and spinning beacon atop the Eiffel Tower came into view. And she asked Amy to keep taking photos as it got closer. When we were right alongside it, I pointed up to the restaurant on the first level above the 4 iron legs and said, "Your mom and I had dinner there." I recalled us splurging, me plunking down my first credit card because we'd burned through most of the few hundred in cash we'd worked all year to save for that summer. Our Eiffel Tower meal and the rest of our days wandering around Europe weren't paid off for several years. And here we were, at it again, spending into the red to live it up, gathering stories. Later, we were up in Montmartre, amid the winding, narrow streets to take in the rooftop night views above that hilly Paris district, when I saw them, a couple, about 20, ascending the stairs from the metro, an overstuffed backpack weighing him down, a duffel slung protectively across her front. She had a guidebook in one hand. They looked disoriented and bushed, but excited to finally be near wherever it was they were headed. There we were, Amy and me those 2 decades ago. I wished them well, as well as us. And I hope that when they were 2 decades older, they, like us, wouldn't trade places with their former selves, as happy as they'd been back then. The rest of my little family is asleep now, my wife and daughter. I'm up late at the desk in our hotel room, writing in the soft light from the window. Every detail we wanted to tell, that's what my mom would have wanted to hear. So I'm telling those details anyway. Telling them to Anya if she's reading this one day. Telling them to the cold Paris night outside. Telling them to you. I'm reluctant to let the day end, to leave the 5th year without my mother and begin the 6th. But we go on, into the life my mother did not know, the life into which she wished us. Through an off-again, on-again Paris rain, Amy, Anya, and I walked a tree-lined sidewalk above the Seine. Our stroll led us to a little row of pet shops, and at Anya's eager suggestion, we crossed the street to investigate. Though she had expressed a reasonable interest in what I told her would be our destination, Notre Dame, with its gargoyles and vast dark interior and story of the hunchback, she was far more amused by the kittens, puppies, hamsters, and mice in the windows. At the 3rd pet shop we came to, Amy and I finally relented and agreed that yes, all right, we could go in for a few minutes. Notre Dame would wait. As we moved from cage to cage, we saw Chihuahuas for 2,800 euros, Persian cats for 1,800 euros, garden variety kittens like the ones kids give away from cardboard boxes in front of American grocery stores sold for 850 euros. Hamsters were 80 euros. As I looked out the pet shop window and down the river at the 13th century building in which Marie Antoinette awaited execution, it occurred to me that, despite the most drastic of efforts to stamp it out, decadence is perennial. But Anya had been too busy flitting from cage to cage, pointing out this then that cute little being, to notice the price cards. When we stepped back outside and walked on, she was lit up, talking with hardly a pause for breath about the turtle and hamster we promised she could have when we return home next August. She's a good sport about all this wandering her parents are putting her through. Our own decadence, I suppose. Later, after the darkness and candles and vaulting stone pillars of Notre Dame, she got herself up for the Louvre and our usual game of pick the postcards from the gift shop and find the artwork. I was concerned about how it'd go. With 18 miles of exhibits, the Louvre is the largest art museum in the world. But we'd unfolded the map, located the ancient Egyptian halls, and set off to find the first work. A little, of course our first goal would have to be little, blue ceramic hippopotamus. It took a while. Room after room of sarcophagi, pots, and sphinxes passed, but Anya showed no signs of flagging. Finally, when I was all but sure that we must have passed it somewhere in the scores of display cases, Anya exclaimed, "There it is!" She held the postcard up to the glass cabinet, and sure enough, there was the little blue hippo. Hippopotamus figurine, 1650 to 1550 BCE. We played our seek-and-find game for several more hours as rain poured on the courtyards and glass pyramids out the tall windows. Then Anya spent her own euros back at the gift shop on a 4-inch plush version of the blue Egyptian hippo, a new friend for her constant bedtime companion, Little Lamb. Amy and I are usually pretty good about knowing and respecting Anya's limits, and one a day is certainly her limit for museums. But the rain was still coming down, so we headed over to see the modern art in the Pompidou Center, where we'd be dry. It went okay for a while. We stood in front of some Braques and Laguerres, and I gave Anya my teacherly 2 cents on cubism, the artist presenting multiple views at once and thereby escaping the constraints of time. More about ideas than feelings, really, I admitted, but I like it anyway. Me too, she said, though I was unsure if earnestly or dutifully. Her earnestness was unmistakable, though, when she asked hopefully, "Can we go now?" "Soon," I told her. I was shot myself, tired to the point of tremulous and bleary. Amy and I just wanted her to see the Warhols and Magritte's before we left. Soon, we promised. But after we'd seen the rest of the Pompidou's permanent collection, it was the famed view from the top floor we had to take in before going. Look at that, I said, as the Eiffel Tower's beacon spun along the bottom of the cloud ceiling. And see, Notre Dame, where we were this morning. Amy clicked photos through the rain-splattered glass. When Anya turned from the view to me, I saw the tear rolling down her cheek. Oh, baby, I said. Anya, Amy lowered her camera. Oh, sweetie, she put her arm around Anya. We wore you out, didn't we? I just want to go back to the hotel, she said quietly. Of course we can, I told her. Of course, baby, Amy said. The rain let up as we walked. We bought pizzas and fruit and bread along the way, went back to the room, crawled under the covers, and watched Nim's Island on Amy's laptop. On the nightstand beside Anya was a little 10-euro Eiffel Tower she'd bought from a street vendor. The Egyptian hippo, Bluey, as Anya had named her, rested snugly under Anya's arm with Little Lamb.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. Join us next time to continue Jonathan Johnson's memoir, The Desk on the Sea. Music for this episode is by Cerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.